From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Sarah Zaman, host of VOA Urdu's TV show, View 360. Our topic, U.S.-Pakistan relations. Will the recent freeze on security assistance to Pakistan by the Trump administration induce Islamabad to take a tougher stance against terror networks? Well, not really, according to our featured guest, Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and that's a prominent think tank here in Washington. Michael, who has appeared frequently as a South Asian analyst on my Encounter program, wrote in a recent article for The Hill newspaper that, quote, while the decision would not torpedo the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, it is unlikely to compel them to crack down on the terrorists that target American troops in Afghanistan, unquote. Michael explains that Pakistan's link to the Afghan Taliban and Haqqani network, groups based in Pakistan that stage attacks in Afghanistan, serve their longstanding national interests. We'll talk with Michael Kugelman about implications of this policy shift for U.S.-Pakistan relations and the effort to bring stability to Afghanistan, as well as his insights from a recent trip to North Waziristan, and that's a Pakistani tribal region, among other related South Asian issues. And Michael Kugelman joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Michael, welcome to the program.
Great to be back with you. Thank you.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Sarah Zaman of VOA's Urdu service.
Thank you very much, Carol.
Host of the new TV program, View 360. Michael, let's talk first about this aid cut to Pakistan. It was President Trump's first official tweet of 2018, and he said, I quote, the United States has foolishly given Pakistan more than $33 billion in aid over the past 15 years, and they have given us nothing but lies and deceit. They give safe haven to the terrorists we hunt in Afghanistan with little or no help. No more, unquote. Now, many analysts say that this sentiment was not necessarily out of line nor entirely unwarranted, but the style, the public messaging, which of course provoked an outcry from Pakistan, perhaps doesn't help. But we do know that Pakistan plays a double game. I'd like to get your view on this policy, and if you think it would help or actually cause the ISI, that's the Pakistan security establishment, to either cling to the current policy or perhaps curtail its current strategy.
Well, if there's one way that's guaranteed not to get the result that the U.S. wants, and that's essentially for Pakistan to finally crack down against terrorist groups like the Afghan Taliban and Haqqani network that target Americans in Afghanistan, the last thing you want to do is to issue a tweet or some type of statement that uses such bullying and harsh language. And for many years, the U.S. has been essentially demanding that Pakistan do what Trump demanded it do in his tweet. But only now do you have such a bullying tone in the rhetoric, and that's unprecedented. So I think that, you know, those of us that study Pakistan have heard this theme so many times before. So we weren't surprised that Trump said what he did. But you know, the fact that he started off the year, his first tweet of the year was focusing on Pakistan, that was striking. And I think it's been clear for quite some time that the Trump administration has wanted to freeze aid to Pakistan. So it was a matter of time. But I think that Trump surprised even his own aides. And I think that people were not ready to actually formally declare that freeze. And essentially, the White House had to scramble after the tweet came in order to formalize what Trump was previewing and telegraphing what would happen.
Quickly, you say that Pakistan's linked to the Afghan Taliban and Haqqani network, these groups that are based in Pakistan and stage attacks in Afghanistan, that they serve longstanding Pakistani national interests. What are those interests?
I mean, it all comes down to the issue of India. India is Pakistan's enemy. They fought multiple wars against each other. And Pakistan believes that the Haqqani network and the Afghan Taliban can help push back against the influence and presence of India in Afghanistan. Now, Pakistan has long accused India of actually using Afghanistan as a staging ground for acts of sabotage and meddling and even terrorism inside Pakistan. So for Pakistan, the Haqqani network and the Afghan Taliban, yeah, they're terror groups, but they help serve useful purposes for Pakistani interests, and that's to essentially keep away what Pakistan regards as an existential threat.
So, Michael, recently the Indian Army chief said that if ordered by the government, the Indian Army would go inside Pakistan and call Pakistan's nuclear bluff. So when you look at that situation, the fears that Pakistan has, is India actually fanning those fears?
I think that India intentionally wants to get Pakistan worried. I mean, Pakistan has long assumed that, you know, it has nuclear weapons, and it has never embraced a no-first-use policy, which means Pakistan has never said that it would not necessarily use nuclear weapons if there were to be some type of conflict between India and Pakistan. And so I think India is essentially saying, well, that doesn't worry us. We're going to do what we need to do. If we need to come in and use military force, we're going to do that, regardless of the nuclear issue. India has previously staged limited military strikes in Pakistan. Well, of course, Pakistan disputes this, but in September 2016, India claimed to have carried out what it described as a surgical strike, limited airstrikes on terrorist facilities on Pakistan-administered Kashmir. Pakistan denied it happened. India insisted it did happen. It's not the first time that something like that has happened. And I imagine that given the state of relations between India and Pakistan right now, which are not very good, India could do something like that again. I'm not saying that India is going to send tanks into Pakistan. That's not in the cards. But I think what the Indian Army chief was saying is that India will reserve the right to defend itself by staging, for instance, more airstrikes against terrorist targets inside Pakistan.
So if the U.S. goal is to get Pakistan to not support terror networks that Pakistan is supporting because it's afraid of Indian policies in the region, what can U.S. do to work with India to mitigate Pakistan's concerns, if anything at all?
Well, see, this is part of the problem. There's a disconnect here. It's true that Pakistan values its relationship with the U.S. because it thinks it could get the U.S. to try to tell India, well, look, you need to back off on what you're doing in the region. You can't threaten Pakistan. You can't stage acts of sabotage. You can't side with separatists in Pakistan. But first of all, the U.S. government does not actually give much credence to these accusations that Pakistan levies on India. According to the U.S. government, India does not provide support to separatist insurgents in Balochistan. According to the U.S. government, India does not provide financial support to the Pakistani Taliban. These are all accusations that are routinely made by Pakistan. So obviously the U.S. is not going to do something if it doesn't think there's a problem to start with. And I think this is part of why you have such a disconnect and a problem in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. Pakistan hopes and expects that the U.S. will do things to help serve Pakistani interests vis-a-vis India, even though the U.S. has no interest in doing that. And also, you know, the U.S. has a deep interest in deepening its relationship with India. The last thing it wants to do is to start suggesting that India is trying to stir up trouble in Pakistan.
Now, with regard to the aid cut, Michael Kugelman, that means that the United States will continue to withhold $255 million, which has already been budgeted in military aid, and they may further freeze $1 billion in other forms of security assistance, bringing the total of security funds that could be held back to at least $1.3 billion. What are the most immediate ramifications? How will, besides being very upset about the way this freeze was announced through tweet, etc., how have the Pakistanis reacted, and what kind of leverage do they have over the United States?
This aid freeze, as I understand it, actually could approach close to $2 billion. For you and me, it's a fair amount of money. But, you know, Pakistan has faced aid freezes in the past. This is not the first time the U.S. has frozen aid. After the U.S. raid on Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan, the U.S. froze millions of dollars in aid. So Pakistan can deal with it. However, I think for Pakistan, it does value a lot of the high-end military equipment that it gets from the U.S. And the official line in Pakistan is that Pakistan does not need American aid. It can look elsewhere, such as China. But China can certainly provide certain things to Pakistan, but there are certain things like F-16s or certain types of military equipment that Pakistanis really look to from the United States. And there's also a prestige element. I think for Pakistan, there's something to be said for being able to depend on the military of the world's sole superpower for military assistance. But all that said, I don't think we should overstate the impact that this aid freeze or this aid cut will have on Pakistan. Ultimately, it will survive. It'll be inconvenient, but it will find ways to deal with this.
Okay, but could the Pakistanis who control supply routes on its own soil used by NATO vehicles to access Pakistan, could they withhold that access?
Right. Good question. You know, what are the ramifications for the U.S.? Absolutely. I mean, Pakistan does have one key tool of leverage, and that is to shut down these supply routes on its soil used by the U.S. to access Afghanistan. And if that happened, it would be, I don't want to say catastrophic, but it would be a big problem for the U.S. because if Pakistan were to close down those supply routes, the U.S. would have to look to alternate routes in Central Asia, which are much more expensive and circuitous. And, you know, that being Russia's sphere of influence, you know, the Russians could try to hamper U.S. access to those areas. However, I would argue that Pakistan is not likely to close down the supply lines just because of an aid freeze from the U.S. Now, let's face it, the aid freeze was declared, you know, several weeks back, and yet the Pakistanis haven't closed down the supply lines. I think that the Pakistanis would prefer to hold their fire, so to speak, and to keep that powerful tool of leverage in reserve until it fears the U.S. could do something more drastic or until the U.S. actually does do something drastic.
We've also seen that despite President Trump's tweets and the aid freeze, high-level talks between Pakistani and American officials are continuing. They have been visiting Pakistan. This good cop, bad cop routine that's going on, where President Trump writes provocative tweets and behind closed doors, Pakistani officials meet American officials. Is this the best way to handle this relationship?
No, it's the worst possible way to handle the relationship. I mean, mixed messages is not a good thing, particularly given that the Pakistan, like so many other countries in the world, views the White House as such an unpredictable administration, so to speak. And, you know, this is not the first time this has happened. I mean, the Obama administration would make threats from time to time, and then it would quietly, behind the scenes, engage in diplomacy. But I think the Obama administration was not as strident and harsh in its rhetoric, and certainly President Obama was not nearly as strident and harsh in his rhetoric as Trump is. But I think it also says something about the confusion in U.S. policy. I think that the U.S. hasn't been able to figure out what kind of policy it wants to have with Pakistan. It certainly is fixated on these concerns about terrorism and these sanctuaries on Pakistani soil. But at the same time, I think it really does value the relationship and it understands the great risks to the U.S. if the relationship were to completely collapse or come to an end.
Well, speaking of that, before we go to a break, Michael, what other specific steps were you about to talk about that the United States could take that might persuade the ISI, the government in Pakistan, and of course its military and intelligence arm, to cut ties to the Haqqani network and other Taliban groups? I've heard some say, you know, maybe revoking Pakistan's non-NATO ally status, etc.
Yeah, there are all kinds of possibilities. You're right. One of them is revoking its non-NATO ally status. So that would be symbolic now, given that that would essentially limit Pakistan's access to American military equipment. But with the aid freeze, it's not getting that anyway. I would look to the possibility of the U.S. placing sanctions and travel bans on individual Pakistani military and intelligence officials regarded as having ties to terrorism. That would be a pretty big deal. If you go up the scale, yeah, I could see the U.S. expanding drone strikes deep into areas of Pakistan that it has not used drone strikes quite often previously, like Balochistan, which is where the top Afghan leadership is based and where you also have some Haqqani network leaders. There could also be, and I think this would be the so-called nuclear option, the possibility of the U.S. starting a process to designate Pakistan as a state sponsor of terrorism. That would be a humiliating thing, among other things, for Pakistan. So if you start getting to those types of possibilities, or even if Pakistan believes that those are impending and that the U.S. may resort to those tactics, then you could see Pakistan conceivably shutting down the supply lines.
All right, well, those are some sticks. Maybe we'll get into some carrots after the break. You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Michael Kugelman. He's Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and that's a think tank here in Washington. And joining me on the program is Sarah Zaman, host of VOA Urdu's TV show, View 360. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Now, here's a big shout out to Imran Khan from Multan, Pakistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Back to our special guest, Michael Kugelman. We're talking about Pakistan. Michael, quickly before I turn back to Sarah for a question, What about carrots for Pakistan to withhold this assistance or support for the Haqqani Network and other Taliban groups? For example, what would persuade them? What could the United States do? Pursue a solution in Kashmir, cutting back ties on India? I mean, what are some steps that they would see as conducive?
You know, I think many in Washington now feel that the U.S. has exhausted all of the possible carrots, and particularly the aid issue. I mean, that's long been seen as the main carrot, so to speak. But American officials, correctly in my view, would conclude that providing all this aid and all these weapons to Pakistan's military has not led it to crack down on these terrorists. I think Pakistan has long complained that the U.S. doesn't appreciate Pakistan's interests and it doesn't do enough to help pursue Pakistan's interests, even though the U.S. expects Pakistan to help further U.S. interests in the region. So yeah, I mean, conceivably, perhaps if the U.S. were, for example, to say, okay, we're going to try to do everything we can to resolve the Kashmir dispute, maybe that would make Pakistan come around in a different way. First of all, I don't see the U.S. doing that because it doesn't want to get involved in the Kashmir dispute, particularly because India, the U.S.'s close friend, feels that dispute is settled and does not want any type of mediation, certainly not external mediation. I think the Pakistanis have also complained that the U.S. does not do enough to deal with what Pakistan describes as terrorist sanctuaries in Afghanistan. Pakistan believes that there are terrorists on Afghan soil that use Afghan soil as a staging ground for terrorist attacks inside Pakistan. It is true in the defense of Pakistan that many of the terrorist attacks in Pakistan over the last year or two have been staged by groups with a presence in Afghanistan, like the Pakistani Taliban and ISIS, for that matter. But here, I think the U.S. would again say, no, we're already doing that. The U.S. government would say there are no terrorist sanctuaries in Afghanistan that we're not targeting. And it's true. You know, the U.S., for example, not too long ago, in a drone strike, I believe, killed the ringleader of the horrific terrorist attack on the army-run school in Peshawar that killed about 150 students back at the end of 2014. So unfortunately, you know, what Pakistan is asking the U.S. to do, that Pakistan says would help its interests, the U.S. has no interest in doing those things because either it doesn't want to or it believes it's already doing them.
So one of the questions that's asked a lot in Pakistan is, how come a superpower that has been fighting a war for 16 years is not getting the results that it wanted, and now it's looking at us and saying, we're the problem? The word being used in Pakistan is scapegoating, that the U.S. is right now scapegoating Pakistan and putting the burden of its own failures onto Pakistan. And they also mentioned that roughly 40% of Afghanistan is right now under Taliban control. The central government has no control on that. How much control does Pakistan have? How much leverage does Pakistan have in this situation, that if only it were to control the Haqqani network or not give sanctuary to the Afghan Taliban, suddenly this would change the entire war theater, and a superpower with all its money and with all its fire and fury has not been able to get those results. But Pakistan would be able to get the results that the U.S. wants.
Well, this is a good point, Sarah, and I actually agree. I think that it's not fair when the U.S. essentially saddles the blame for all of the problems in the Afghanistan war on Pakistan uniquely. It's almost routine to hear, you know, within the corridors of power here in Washington that it's all about these sanctuaries in Pakistan. If only Pakistan eliminated these sanctuaries, it would basically make the situation in Afghanistan a lot better. That's not true, in my view. I don't think if you smash these Taliban sanctuaries in Pakistan, and that would not magically make the insurgency go away. It's not that simple. You know, I would argue that there are a lot of factors in Afghanistan that have helped strengthen the Taliban insurgency. One, quite frankly, is that the military in Afghanistan simply is not up to the task. It's made major improvements after all these years of training from the U.S. and its allies, but it still struggles to push back the Taliban. And I would also fault the Afghan government. The current government and also the previous one, the Hamid Karzai government, these are governments that were widely regarded as corrupt and inefficient. Now, unfortunately, the Afghan government has been unable to convince a critical mass of Afghans that the government is a better alternative to the Taliban. So that basically means that, you know, you have plenty of Afghans that are willing to join the Taliban because they see their government as a government that's not willing to help them. And so I think that all helps the Taliban. And it's not just the Pakistan factor, but...
Well, speaking of that, what's your assessment of the current administration's revised policy toward Afghanistan? We note that 4,000 additional troops were approved to go to Afghanistan, and recently about 1,000 combat advisors are on their way to Afghanistan. Others say, you know, it's not just military, there has to be a civilian component. How do you assess the new U.S. strategy?
Well, I mean, I think the strategy is good in the sense that finally there's a clear-cut objective that's been articulated. President Trump, back in August when he announced the strategy, basically cast it in a counterterrorism lens. He said that we're going to stay there to make sure we eliminate al-Qaeda and ISIS and prevent the Taliban from ever taking power again. So that's a good thing, because I felt that for so many years, the U.S. government has never really articulated a clear goal. In effect, why are we still there? Why are we still fighting there? But I think that this strategy is flawed, because the idea of the strategy is to put more pressure on the Taliban on the battlefield, give U.S. forces more flexibility to go after the Taliban in the hopes that that will put the Taliban on the defensive, weaken it, turn the tide of the war, and make the Taliban willing to step off the battlefield and negotiate a peace process. Well, that's exactly what we did in 2010 when we had, you know, more than 100,000 U.S. troops on the ground. It didn't work then. Why should it work now when we have 13, 14,000 troops? But absolutely, there needs to be an accompanying diplomatic strategy. Now, a lot was mentioned about the fact that when Trump announced the Afghanistan strategy, he was on a military base, and naturally he was going to talk about the military components. This strategy is not going to work unless you have an accompanying diplomatic and an economic strategy, for that matter. So I hope that eventually we find out that there is one. Hopefully what we heard from Trump back in August when he was announcing the strategy is not the last of it, and there'll be more than that.
So talking about a negotiated settlement, recently this news surfaced that there were purported talks held in Turkey between Afghan government representatives and a few representatives of the Taliban that have an office in Qatar. But very soon after that, both parties denied any such meeting. But the Afghan Peace Council, without naming Taliban, later on said that with opposition groups, especially armed opposition groups, there have been some kind of contact just to get the negotiation started. But those who covered this news also said that this looked more like an attempt by the Afghan intelligence agency to sort of stage some kind of talks and to make it look like they're making advances on that front. What do you think of all of this?
Yeah, it's hard to know for sure what's going on, but I would say that I imagine there was a meeting. I imagine that there was some interactions between some Taliban members and some members of the Afghan government in Turkey. This was not an officially sanctioned meeting. There's no indication that top central Taliban leadership was fully behind this. But if you look back at the history of the last decade or so, there's been a fair number of these unofficial meetings between the Taliban and the Afghan government. Unfortunately, they haven't gotten anywhere. I think what's more significant is that there's now been indications that there was a separate meeting between Taliban officials and Afghan officials in Pakistan, and that this one was, in fact, approved, so to speak, by the top leader of the Afghan Taliban, Mullah Akhundzada. Again, you know, the truth and the facts are oftentimes elusive. I think it's encouraging that these meetings are happening, but, you know, I, for one, am very skeptical that these types of meetings, whether they're unofficial or official, that they'll lead to anything big. I mean, why would the Taliban want to step off the battlefield and negotiate an end to the war when it's been able to take over so much territory in so little time? And for now, at least, it's still on the offensive, unless it fears that the Trump administration is going to come in and put on the accelerator, so to speak, and intensify the fight against the Taliban. Maybe it thinks that. Otherwise, I don't see why the Taliban would take these types of meetings seriously.
Michael Kugelman, as we close the program, I'd like to turn back to Pakistan. I'd like you to talk about your recent trip to North Waziristan. That's, of course, a Pakistani tribal region. It's long been a haven for terrorists. It's been described as the most dangerous place on earth. What was the purpose of your trip, and what did you glean from it?
Yeah, well, the purpose of the trip for me was just to see how things are looking in an area that had been, at one point, a magnet for the worst terrorists in the world, from al-Qaeda to the Taliban and many in between. I went on the trip with the Pakistani military, and the Pakistani military for several years has been waging a vicious counter-terrorism offensive against the Pakistani Taliban, the main group responsible for terrorist attacks in Pakistan over the last 2 years. I think the military wanted to show me and the other U.S. analysts that were with me that there's been progress, that, you know, you don't have a terrorism problem anymore. And it was quite striking because, sure enough, you know, when we flew in this U.S.-made helicopter from Islamabad into North Waziristan, we got off and it was peaceful in the literal sense. I mean, there was all this new construction, all these new roads, no terrorist in sight. The fact that the Pakistani military brought several Americans to this area suggests that there was a level of safety with the military in tow. But clearly, what I was seeing was what the military wanted me to see. It was sort of, to use the term, a Potemkin village effect. In other words, it was sort of, I don't want to say make-believe, but it was deceiving. And certainly what I saw and what my American colleagues saw was a small area of Waziristan that had been pacified by the military and under the complete control of the military. But beyond the area that I saw, and this was the capital city of Mihrinshahr, there was certainly good reason to think that things were a lot different. And, you know, just local news reports from the time I was there in Pakistan indicated that there had been some terrorist attacks and some very troubling things happening. So it was a useful trip to see what the military had done, but at the same time, I think it was important for me and my colleagues that were with me to take everything with some very healthy grains of salt.
I'd like you to talk also about one of your points in your article entitled Progress and Peril in North Waziristan. You say that Pakistan still nurtures an environment that enables extremism inside the country, and of course that reverberates outside. Talk about what you mean.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, the state, the Pakistani state, continues to provide sanctuary to terrorists. So that in of itself, I think, contributes to an environment for extremism. Basically, the Pakistan is providing space to extremists, terrorists. And also, if you look on the societal lens, I mean, you just have a lot of manifestations of hate speech and extremist views and ideas percolating through society without anything being done by the state to address it. So, for example, I mean, this gets a lot of attention. You know, you have public school textbooks in Pakistan that routinely describe India as the enemy and call for India to be destroyed, call for the U.S. to be destroyed. You have religious leaders, including the person that runs a local mosque, a local cleric, giving these speeches, Friday sermons, that are extremely violent and calling for, you know, attacks on religious minorities in Pakistan or attacks on India. And then, quite frankly, even the media in Pakistan, which in many ways is a big success story, it's a lot more pugnacious and free than it may have been some years ago, but you have some private television channels, which are very popular in Pakistan, that have news anchors, media personalities, that say some really vicious and nasty things that I would view as hate speech. And yet, they're not sanctioned, nothing happens to these people. The authorities don't do anything about it.
I'd love to get Sarah Zaman's view. We have our own in-house resource here. What's your view, Sarah, as a Pakistani?
So Pakistan actually, just very recently, the government of Pakistan and a very large number of clerics, almost 1,800 clerics in Pakistan, released this statement. It's called Pegham-e-Pakistan in Urdu, which means the message of Pakistan, and it basically denounces any kind of terrorist activity in Pakistan. It says that it's neither something that Pakistan could stand for, and also that it brings a bad name to the religion, and this cannot be sanctioned in the name of Islam, any kind of terrorism. So in terms of developing a new, or at least now a more enthusiastic narrative than before, this is being seen as an attempt at that, because in the past there have been clerics who have issued what they call fatwas, religious edicts, against terrorism, but this was the first time that the civilian government put its weight behind it as well. The question that I want to ask you, Michael, is going back to the tweet that Carol read out by President Trump, there's a lot of talk about the lies and deceit and the double game and everything. What have Pakistan and the United States gained from this relationship with each other?
Well, actually, quite a lot. And I think this tends to be forgotten, given all the hostility and the nasty rhetoric coming from both sides. But Pakistan has benefited from, first of all, getting a fair amount of military assistance that it wouldn't have been able to easily get elsewhere. And it's gotten a lot of money. Now, you can go into the details about whether that money was used for the purposes that it should have been. And, you know, as I had said earlier, Pakistan has benefited from having a military partnership with the world's most powerful military. That's something that Pakistan doesn't take lightly. In terms of the U.S., what it's gotten a number of things. I mean, for many years, Pakistan let the U.S. use Pakistani military bases to house personnel, including CIA folks and contractors. And so, you know, I think that there have been very specific, tangible benefits that each side has derived from the other. But I think the biggest question now, looking forward, is, you know, what does each side have to lose if the relationship falls apart? And I don't think the relationship is going to fall apart completely, because I think each side concludes that it has too much to lose to allow that to happen. And for instance, I think that the U.S. really worries about Pakistan essentially not only suspending, you know, the supply routes, which would make the U.S. war effort in Afghanistan even that more difficult, but also Pakistan could completely cut off intelligence intelligence support and military support, which would make it very difficult for the U.S. to operate its drone war and to go after new terrorist threats in the region like ISIS, which Pakistan has actually been helpful with. And Pakistan, I think, it really would not want to be in a position where it could not depend on the largesse, particularly in terms of military support from the United States.
Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Michael, thank you for coming in, sharing your terrific insights on this complicated U.S.-Pakistani relationship.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Larry Pronko, and joining me on the program was Sarah Zaman, host of VOA Urdu's TV show View 360. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.